I think one is making a commitment. First, one is noticing your pattern. If you notice it well enough, then you'll notice one morning you get up and you're cold and or tired and you say, well, I'm going to put it off. And you say, wait a minute, I've done this 92 times already. You know, put it off and I haven't sat the end of the day. I think I'm wising up to my pattern. So from that from the wisdom of that observation, you might, after the 93rd time, say, you know, this thought about putting it off, I'm not going to buy into it. I'm going to just do it anyway. So that's one thing, which actually I think is somewhat significant to say. So it's from our understanding that commitment arises. But commitment also arises out of commitment, out of not necessarily understanding, but just really being committed. And it's very, very valuable to make an uncompromising commitment to sitting every day. Not everyone has to do this, so this is more like a strategy. But it's a very valuable strategy to make an unwavering commitment to sit every day, more or less at the same time, like early in the morning, no matter what occurs. Because there's always going to be, often going to be something else that's going to occur that's going to want you to do differently. Or your preferences are going to be, oh, I don't feel so good today, so I'm not going to sit. Or I feel really great today, so who needs to sit? You know, all these thoughts go through our mind. But if you have an unwavering commitment where the sitting occurs outside of your preferences, whether you want to or not, then there's the opportunity of letting the full range of who you are over time pass through the field of mindfulness. And that's considered very valuable. It also develops discipline, which is very valuable also, an important quality. In the monasteries where I practiced, we didn't have the option of, you know, not getting up and sitting. So there were mornings where I just went kicking and screaming or just hated it. But I had to go. In a monastic setting where there's a kind of external authority, sometimes that kind of unwavering commitment can be misunderstood or a little unhealthy at times. But when it's just you on your own, I think it can be really wonderful to do it that way. So I don't know if that helps you, those two things. Learn from your... good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So the first thing is just be more observant, and from that learn what your patterns are, and then correct based on what you learn. And the second is raise up to the occasion with more firmer commitment, and do it regardless. Whether you want to or not, whether you're tired or not. We do it even if you think it's going to be the world's worst meditation because, you know, you're nauseous and sick and tired and, you know, whatever. You know, you think this is going to be the total failure as a meditation, so why bother? Do it anyway. And one interesting variation of this is, so a commitment to sitting, you know, a certain length of time each morning, and say it's 40 minutes, and then one morning, you're on the brink of total ecstasy and bliss and delight at 39 minutes. Ah, this is what I want. And so you're told, then rather than getting up, I'm going to sit here for the next 4 hours. But your commitment is just sit for 40 minutes. So then you have to get up and leave your ecstasy also. No, you don't want that, huh? Because what we're cultivating in this practice is not any particular state, but rather is any particular experience of the state, but rather is a mind which doesn't cling to anything, and a mind which doesn't cling can allow any state to go through it. Bliss, you know, heaven or hell can go through a mind that doesn't cling. Does that make sense? Okay, well. So, one or two? Yes?
Yeah, I have a similar difficulty. He's talked about getting up, not feeling like it, and then getting to the afternoon and too tired or forget about it. But the difference is that I'm aware of part of the reason why. It's because when I get into it, I start to feel a lot of anxiety.
Oh.
And it's like an agitation in the legs. And it's like, it's, it doesn't go away, or it does, not that it's post necessarily, it's just really heavy. And so I've been really avoiding doing it, and I don't like that. And I want to do it more, and I don't know how to get through that.
Okay. Well, that's something maybe we could talk about, you know, more one-on-one. Might be more useful than spending extended time now talking about what's going on with you. But in kind of a short answer is that the anxiety or the agitation in your legs or whatever, that itself becomes the meditation. So rather than thinking that that's getting in the way of the meditation, and then you have this tension between what's going on and what you think you're supposed to be doing, you relax, you give up whatever you think is supposed to happen, and put your full meditative attention on the agitation itself or the anxiety itself. And in doing that, if you can kind of imagine, the body is kind of like a container, and you kind of open or relax into the container of the body and let the agitation and the anxiety or the nervousness just course through your body freely, and your body just holds it all in its awareness. And then what can happen is, with that kind of freedom to the anxiety begins to abate in its own good time. So that's the short answer, but if you want to talk more one-on-one, we can do that. Last one, yes?
One of the things that I've been noticing is that the rest of my day, when I'm not meditating, I want to use what I've learned throughout the day. And is that all right? To clarify that, I'll be thinking something or doing something and find myself saying, I'm doing, this is what's happening now, I'm doing this, or I'm feeling this, or whatever, and I find myself sort of in the mindset when I'm sitting meditating. Is that, I guess my question is, does that then take away from the specific time of meditation?
Oh, that's a beautiful question, and also ties into what the theme of today is going to be, which is bringing mindfulness into daily life. So your question is the one thing is to do the mindfulness in a meditation practice, and the other is to start doing a similar mindfulness in daily life. And you're asking, is that okay? And does that distract from the stuff in meditation? Is that the question?
Pretty much.
Please extend the mindfulness in daily life. There's no real divide between meditation and normal life. And as a person deepens in their meditation practice, it naturally, there's an impetus to want to extend that mindfulness into all our activities. And that's what today will be about. Okay, so now we have a quorum for meditation. So take a comfortable and alert posture. And softly close your eyes. And then take a couple of deep breaths, breathing into your body, connecting to the body, breathing out, relaxing, letting go. And then letting your breath be normal, let it breathe itself. Take a few moments also to relax any of the larger muscles in the body that might be tense, even if it's just a hint of softening. Softening the forehead, softening the forehead and the eyes. Sometimes it's possible to relax the nose, the cheeks, the jaws, and then soften your shoulders, Sometimes on the exhalation, it can be useful to relax the shoulders a little bit. Sometimes it's possible to relax the chest, release it. And to relax the stomach, let the stomach become soft, let it hang out. And then also the brain, as if the brain was a muscle. See if you can release the brain, soften and relax there in your head, letting go of your thoughts and concerns of the day. And then become aware of your breathing. Become aware of how the body experiences the process of breathing. Breathing in, breathing out. With time, the process of mindfulness meditation is a process of deepening trust. It's kind of like if you jump into the ocean, you can learn to relax and the ocean will hold you up quite nicely. You can jump into the middle of your life, middle of what's happening right now. You don't need to do anything, figure anything out, fix anything. You will be held up gently if you give up control. Letting yourself rest on the ocean of sensations with breath. The expanding sensations of breathing in. The releasing sensations of breathing out. Whenever the mind wanders off into thought, open your awareness again to receive the breathing, to resume your mindful breathing. Seeing if you can maintain and sustain a soft connection between awareness and your breathing. So you're present for the full cycle of inhalations and exhalations, in a gentle way. When some strong body sensation arises in the meditation and pulls on your attention, let go of the breath and let your awareness settle itself on the strong physical sensation, letting there be a meditative awareness of what's happening in your body, allowing the sensation to be there. If a strong emotion tugs on your awareness, let go of the breath again and bring your awareness to the emotion. Let your meditative, quiet, meditative, non-judgmental awareness hold the emotional state, holding how it feels in the body to have that emotion present. Returning to your breath whenever the physical sensation or emotion no longer needs to be acknowledged or has faded away or no longer tugs on you. Coming back to your breath. Not just mechanically, but coming back to the breath with some interest, some soft interest, some interest to get to know the breath better, to have greater intimacy with the experience of breathing. Relaxing from your thoughts and concerns, and surrendering yourself, yielding yourself to the experience of breathing. have this object here in my hand, which I think you can all hopefully see, and you know, get some sense of what it is, see it for what it is. Some of you will have a label or name that you attach to it, what you think it is or whatever. But anyway, you see what it is. And Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on, as a cliche almost, or slogan, things as they are. And the point of Buddhist meditation practice is to learn to see things as they are. Or in Mahayana Buddhism, they talk about being present for the thusness of things, for the suchness of things, for the, how things are in and of themselves, as opposed to the concepts and ideas we impose on them. So you have you see something, you see this thing, and maybe it looks a little bit unusual object to some of you, but you have some sense of what it is, as it is. But then if I hold up this one here, this object here, which kind of looks like kind of similar kind of material, then we can do something very interesting. We can say this object is the long one, and this one's the small one. The big one, the small one, the long one, the short one, the fatter one, the thinner one. And what's interesting is that those labels, larger, smaller, longer, shorter, thinner, fatter, they don't belong to the objects themselves. The thusness of the object, the things as it is not long or short, it's just what it is. Long or short is a comparative statement that the mind makes. It's a convention and idea that the mind makes, because, so this now, this is the long one, right? And if I hold up this one also, where's the long one? It's this one, right? If I hold up these two, which is the long one, which is the short one? What was long before is now short. It in and of itself hasn't changed one bit. The thusness of this thing, the thing in and of itself hasn't changed. But what's changed is the way the mind can compare the two things depending on what you place it next to. So this is a very important principle in Buddhist teachings. And maybe this kind of abstract way doesn't have much meaning for you. But, when I was 13 or so, it was back in 1967, and I grew up partly in Italy and partly in Los Angeles. And I went to Italy in 1967, in the spring, and this little provincial city in Italy, and I had the longest hair of anybody in the city. And I was the only one wearing blue jeans. And I was cool. And I knew that I was cool. I was kind of proud of myself. I'd go around that city, kind of with my long hair waving and wind and all that. So then in September, I came back to the United States, to Los Angeles. And while I was gone, things had changed rapidly. Summer of 67. And everybody's hair was, all the guys' hair was so much longer than my hair was. And I just had blue jeans, but they had these stonewashed blue jeans that were torn and patched, and, you know, I just had blue jeans. So suddenly I was not cool anymore. And the only thing that had changed was I flew across the Atlantic. And in one side of the Atlantic, I was the coolest guy in town. I was cool. That's who I was. Thank you. And when I came to the United States, I was kind of a bummer. It was a bum trip. Suddenly, I was not the coolest guy around anymore. I was kind of like behind it. I was kind of like, you know. So my sense of who I was very much had to do with how I compared myself to others. I could compare how I compared my hair to others or my clothes to others. And my sense of my well-being and how I felt about myself depended on how I was comparing myself to the Italians on one hand, who weren't part of the California hippie culture yet, or the hippies in California who kind of were way ahead of me when I came back. Who I was as a human being was lost. And who I was kind of as in the essence, as I was myself, was caught up in my comparative thinking. And we do that a lot. You know, we have big noses, small noses, we have more hair and less hair, we have bigger bodies or smaller bodies, and we have all these thoughts and ideas about our, you know, who we are, that a lot of times have just simply exist problematically because we hold them in comparison to other people. They only exist in comparison to other people. So, for example, I might consider myself to be a very bad basketball player. Lousy basketball player. The question then is, that you'd ask, compared to what? Because it's a comparative statement. Lousy basketball player doesn't exist in the universe by itself. It isn't like you point, you know, it's a platonic principle, you know. It's not a category. Lousy basketball player, that's what it looks like. Everybody knows. It's lousy basketball player is comparison, because if I compare myself to Michael Jordan, it's true. If I compare myself to a 13-year-old, oh, to Allison. Thank you, Allison. Compared to Allison, I'm, you know, a pro. Boy, I'm cool. Thank you. Now I know who I am. So it's comparative thinking. So many of us, and a lot, for many of us, our sense of well-being, who we are, can blow like the winds of fame or something, can blow depending on what we're comparing ourselves to, what we choose to compare ourselves to. And this comparative thinking belongs to concepts and ideas, the cognitive world. And what happens when the cognitive world of ideas begins to do comparative thinking, it tends to only agitate the mind, and the mind only starts thinking more and more. Because for me to remain the cool 13-year-old in Italy, it isn't like a done deal. You know, now I know who I am. But I have to constantly be thinking that in order to really kind of remind myself and re-inspire myself in that coolness. Or if your nose is too big, it isn't like you know it once and for all. I think we are constantly reminding ourselves, you know, or kind of checking out other people's noses, finding out, you know, how do I fit in here with my nose? So the mind gets kind of can get more and more busy. To begin to experience the thusness of things, to see things directly as they are, is for one thing a great relief. To experience ourselves in our thusness without needing to compare ourselves to anything is a phenomenal relief. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is to help us to begin to have that clear seeing and that trust where we can just be ourselves, be present, without the filter of concepts and judgments, evaluations, comparative thinking that many of us, I believe, are often plagued by. And many of us are so involved in comparative thinking and in concepts and ideas and conventions that we don't see it. It's like we don't a fish doesn't see the water it swims in. We don't often see the concepts we swim in. And because we don't see it, we don't see that concepts are optional. We can have an experience of ourselves, experience of being alive, that is not done through the filter of a concept or a comparative thought or idea. So, to experience the breathing, the inhalation, the exhalation, the breath itself is not a concept or an idea, it's a physical reality. And when we begin to rest ourselves in something very simple like the breath, we are choosing to rest in something that we can connect to directly, as opposed to the usual way of connecting to concepts and ideas. And part of the reason why people tend to get calm when they do breath meditation, not always, but tend to be, is that we're no longer fueling and adding to the busy thoughts of comparative thinking and concepts and ideas, the stories of the mind, which is where the stress is born. Stress is born in our thoughts, for the most part, the way our thoughts, our mind reacts to things. And so the breath tends to be kind of quiet, to calm us down a little bit. But the function of mindfulness is not to just make us experts on the breath only, but rather is to help us to be more present, to kind of be able to kind of rest, be more comfortable with being present with the breath, for example, and then to open the awareness up and notice what else we can notice that's happening in the present moment. The idea is to stay in the present moment for things as they are and not the commentaries about what's going on, the comparative thinking. So we look around. And so one of the things that happens is we have a physical body. And so we learn to embody our body, to experience what it's like to be in a body, to feel it. Because in order to become whole, we have to also include our body. The cognitive world of ideas and comparative thinking tends to divide up the world in all kinds of ways. And it tends to divide up how well we can know ourselves. Many of us who have jobs that require a lot of intellectual activity sometimes develop a strong habit of always being in our thoughts and our stories and ideas, and have lost touch with our physical reality, our embodied reality, what it's like to be embodied. To be human beings, to be embodied and experience the world through our body and the body sensations and the body antennas, organs of perception. So we open up and begin experiencing life through our body as it's experienced in the present moment. And in this sense, we can do a little experiment. You might close your eyes for a moment, just as you are. Many of us have ideas and concepts about our body. We have all these ideas that, you know, we have too much hair, too little hair, our body's too fat, too thin, too much around the midline, too much around the chest, too little, too much that, too much this, too gray, too whatever, noses, glasses, hairlines, too much this, too much that. Think about the concepts and ideas that you have, how you think about your body, or how you thought about your body before in the past. What are some of these ideas you've had about your body? And then see, what does it feel like to be inhabiting, to be engaged in those kinds of thoughts about your body? Are they judgment-free? So now take a few deep breaths, clear your mind, keeping your eyes closed. And now, what is your body's experience of itself? How does your body experience itself at this moment? And then what's the difference between these two ways of being? Being in your thoughts and your ideas about your body versus being in your body itself and experiencing it from the inside. So open your eyes. So what was that like?
I had my conceptions about my body were full of judgment, most of them negative, but all of them negative, and either more than or less than. And my body's experience, and my body was just sort of, it was. Absolutely no judgments at all. Sensations of pain here and there, but other than that, completely value-free.
Was it a relief?
Yeah, yeah, really.
Thank you. Yes?
I was more aware of my body when we shifted, that I couldn't stop the words in my head from describing the difference.
Yeah, I apologize for you know, bringing bad news to you, or suggesting exercise which maybe wasn't so nice, but that's actually very observant and very important to recognize, is that there's very strong momentum in the mind around these kinds of things. It's not so easy sometimes just to stop. Yes.
Both of them were, I mean, were comparative, but the first is comparing more to the outside world and thinner, taller, shorter, whatever, than someone else. But the body sensations to me are still comparative. It's something that hurts more than it did yesterday. So it's still comparative.
So your head hurts now?
Yeah.
So close your eyes for a moment.
I don't want to do it all by myself.
Okay. Well, it's possible to just to experience the hurt. By itself.
But I only know that it's hurting because it's different than it's not.
You think so?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think you can know pain directly without needing to compare it to anything. There are certain things we can know very directly without the filter of concepts or comparative thinking. And the raw sensory experience of pressure, of pain, of movement, are very simple sensations that exist irregardless of what we're thinking about them or how we compare them to anything else. The question of hurt hurts more, that's a concept. But pain itself is just pain. You seem challenged by this idea.
I'm not sure I do.
Okay, well, it's okay. One more? Anybody else who wants to share? Yes?
Well, I was thinking about how my face looks. And then when I was experiencing my head from the inside, I was feeling all the how sensorially alive it is. You know, how there's smell and there's sight and there's taste and there's a lot of sensation in the inside.
Beautiful. Well, our aliveness is not experienced through our ideas. Our aliveness is experienced through our embodiment of being in a body. And anyway, so part of waking up to life as it is, to things as they are, and being present to what's going on in the present moment, is to start being experiencing things through the body as part of the body, not just through our ideas. So we become aware of the body. And part of it is also to open up to our emotional life and our feelings that go on. And experience them in the same way. Experience them again, if it's possible, without, in and of themselves, as they are. Seeing the emotions as they are in themselves, the dustness of them, as opposed to seeing them through the filter or of comparative thinking. You know, we get depressed, and we don't just simply let the depression be there, but we add meaning to it. Or we add value judgments on top of what it means to be depressed. Or we react to it on the shame to let anybody know. Or we have aversion to it. Or this means that I am going to be depressed, you know, forever or whatever. We add meaning to it. But simply to experience the depression as depression without adding anything to it is actually a great relief. And it is a possibility. And part of what we're learning to do in waking up to what's in the present moment is to let things be by themselves in their own glory, in a sense, and learning to see a difference between leaving things alone in their glory versus seeing them through a filter of ideas and concepts. It's a form of great relief to do that. So, so we learn to do this in meditation practice. But meditation practice is not really our mind, our body, our hearts is not any different in meditation than it is in normal life. And it's completely makes sense sooner or later to for people to feel that there's no reason to make a sharp division between them. And then there's an interest to try to bring their mindfulness practice into daily life. And I'm just delighted when someone who's done a meditation for a while comes and says, This meditation is great, I'm committed to doing it, but really what I want to do is to try to bring my mindfulness, I want to apply it into my daily life. How do I do it? And I think that's a beautiful question. And I can't give any simple answer, just there's infinite number of answers of how to do that. But having the interest and the motivation to see the usefulness of bringing mindfulness into a normal life is very, very helpful. There's a story, a fairy tale of this king, who had, in the fairy tale, it says he had three sons. Let's say there's a queen, and she has three sons, and she's the ruler of the country. And she gets really sick, and looks like she's going to die. And she hears from some wise minister that there's this water of healing somewhere in the kingdom, in the queendom, that where she can go out and if someone finds it, will heal her. So the first eldest son says, well, I'll go out and find it. And he thinks to himself, if I find it and able to heal her, surely she'll let me inherit the kingdom, the queendom. And so he gets on his horse and gallops out through the gates of the palace and city gates. And the first thing he encounters is this ugly little, you know, like dwarf, poor beggar, dwarf. And now the dwarf says, "Where are you going?" And he just gallops right by because he doesn't have time to stop. The second son afterwards decides, "Well, my brother didn't come back, so maybe I'll go off and look for this great healing water." And he goes out to the front gates, and the beggar says, "Hey, where are you going?" And he just gallops right by because he doesn't have time for beggars. He's doing his important mission. And same thing happens to him. He gets stuck up in the mountains. So then the youngest brother thought, "Well, maybe I'll go out and check, see if I can find some of this water to heal my mother." And he goes out to the gates of the town, and he sees that little beggar there, dwarf. And he stops and gets off his horse and says, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And the dwarf says, "No, but what are you doing?" And the prince says, "I'm going off to find the healing water to try to cure my mother, the queen." And so the dwarf says, "Oh, look behind that tree over there." And he does, and he finds the water, and he takes it back, and he cures his mother. Nice story, huh? So the way I tie it into what I'm teaching... Stretch? It's a stretch. Is a lot of what mindfulness is about, especially in daily life, is in some sense us pausing or stopping so we can see more clearly. Stopping and seeing. When they translated Buddhist words into Chinese pictographs, characters, the word for concentration, and concentration and mindfulness are often go close together. The word for concentration they translated by the word stop. And the word for mindfulness they translated into the character to look. Stop and look was the idea in Chinese. And the idea of stopping and looking. So that's what the youngest prince did. He went out and he stopped and he paid attention. He said, "What's going on here?" And by paying attention, he was, you know, he learned a lot what he was looking for. Many of us are way ahead of ourselves and rushing ahead, rushing into the future, planning, still stuck in the past. But to some degree, pausing, not to be pausing to be in the middle of the day, not pausing to be inactive, not pausing to be passive, but pausing to be actively mindful or aware. What is happening here? What's going on here? It's incredibly powerful to bring mindfulness to bear on a situation which is challenging. Many of us are so quick to react and respond and defend ourselves and do whatever we want in challenging situations. But one of the great things we can do is stop and be mindful, is to actually pause and say, "What's going on here?" And actually look around. And people you're with might not even notice. It might be so subtle they don't even notice. But to actually take some time, not to rush in with reactions, but to take some time to pause and look around. Well, maybe I say this backing up. So I want to talk mostly about ways to help you bring the mindfulness practice into daily life. But actually, if we take daily meditation practice as being kind of the fulcrum of a Buddhist spiritual life, a daily sitting practice is extremely valuable. And what somebody was saying when I first misunderstood you, because you said, "I skipped my meditation in the morning, and at the end of the day I find myself too tired." And I thought that was the end. I thought the conclusion was, because I skipped the meditation, I was tired at the end of the day. That was my first thought, but then I understood that's not what you meant. But many people have the experience that if you have a regular sitting practice over some months and then stop a little bit, you'll see your life isn't as lubricated, things don't go so smoothly as you've gotten used to. So daily sitting practice is very useful. The way to continue Buddhist practice beyond a daily sitting practice is you can take one of two routes. And most people take both routes, but you can take one. There's two routes to take, kind of forks off. One way is to develop more concentration in the practice, to do the mindfulness with greater concentration and I don't know if intensity is the word I want to use, but anyway, intensity. And the way we do that primarily in our tradition is by going on retreats, going for one-day retreats, weekend retreats, or longer retreats. We have quite common in our tradition is 10-day retreats, 10-day silent retreats, where it's 10 days in silence, you're cultivating this kind of mindfulness practice in a very concentrated way. And some people will go even much longer, 3 months, 8 months, longer retreats. But allowing yourself to have the experience of a concentrated experience of yourself is quite a phenomenal thing. Most of us in our daily life do so many different things, and our mind is going so many different places that we're somewhat strangers to ourselves. But to actually enter a place where you're not talking for some number of days, and you're not listening to the radio or reading the paper or going to work or having all these things to do, but just really there to develop your mindfulness of yourself, mindfulness of what's happening, it provides a phenomenal intimacy with oneself that is unparalleled to what most people have in normal life, and any kind, especially in any kind of normal experience of daily life. So that's one way. And some of you might be inspired as you continue your practice to take this delightful way of going on retreats. The other fork out of a daily sitting practice is now what I'm talking about, is bringing the practice of mindfulness into your daily life, or including it as part of your daily life. An important part of that is being interested, feeling it's important to do that. Part of the reason it's such a relief to do it is that you'll start noticing in your daily life how much of your unhappiness and suffering arises when you don't allow things be as they are, but you get involved with comparative thinking, or you get involved with reacting or resisting what's going on. So just learning to let things be rather than resisting, rather than wanting to be different or being attached to our desires is very, very relieving for most of us. One of the very interesting ways of bringing mindfulness into daily life is during the transition from our daily sitting practice, sitting in meditation in the morning, from the transition from ending that sitting period and going into our normal life. Some meditators will sit very diligently for however long they sit in the morning, and then the end of their meditation session, they just will pop out of their cushion, grab the coffee, grab the newspaper, turn on the radio, do it all at once, rush out the door, get to work, just in the nick of time, if even that. And some of the calm and subtleness has maybe been dissipated in that kind of frenzy. But more importantly, there's a way in which, at the end of the session, I don't have to pay attention anymore. Let's just kind of get lost in life again. One of the ways to bring the meditation practice, the mindfulness into daily life, is to not just simply give up the practice at the end of your morning meditation, but actually continue, enter your normal life, start doing the things you normally do, but maybe do it a little bit slower than you normally would, and do it in such a way that you continue noticing what happens in the present moment as you begin picking up the normal activities of your life. And notice what it is that happens when you most lose it, when you most get lost and preoccupied by what's going on in daily life. Make a study of that, because what happens if you start noticing when it is you get lost, when you get distracted or preoccupied, when you get distracted so you're no longer in the present moment, you'll learn something valuable about yourself. For example, it could be that you're fine until you get in your car and when you're going to drive. And you notice that when you're driving, you're not present at all. You get lost. Then you have the opportunity to say, well, how is it that I'm driving that causes me to lose my presence? Oh, it's because when I drive, I'm always in a hurry. And I'm kind of tense and pushing myself forward. My mind just takes off and thinks about the office. Is this the way I want to live my life? And you might say, yes, which is your option. Or you have the opportunity to say, wait a minute, is this really how I want to live my life? Maybe not. So then you start driving mindfully, and then it isn't the drive which you lose it, but rather it's something later in the day. Are you following me? So it's actually lovely to kind of continue being mindful of what's happening in the present moment after your meditation, as you go in, have your breakfast, or do whatever you're going to do next, drive to work. Mindfulness practice is phenomenally easy. It's supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be very simple. It's phenomenally simple. It's supposed to be very, very simple. If you think it's complicated, use the mantra, simplify, simplify. Just very simple. It's like opening your awareness to notice what's happening in the present moment in a very simple, direct way. If you have to start thinking about what's happening, you've gone too far. So mindfulness is very, very simple. But it's not easy. And what's not easy about it is to remember to do it. That's what's not easy, to remember to do it. So what some people will do to bring mindfulness into daily life is they'll have cues throughout the day that remind them to wake up and pay attention. And there's many cues people can use. I used for a long time doorways. And whenever I walked through a door, that would remind me, oh, pay attention to what's going on. It was very valuable because you walk through a doorway, you're walking into a new space. It makes sense to kind of pay attention. But I would use doorways, and the more doorways I went through in a given day, the more likely I was going to be, more often I'd be present. Some people will use the telephone if they have a phone rings a lot. And rather than picking up the telephone at the first ring, they'll let it ring 3 or 4 or 5 times. And just kind of be with their breath a few times, or just be with mindfulness of listening, or just kind of stop and pay attention to how they're feeling and what's going on in a very simple way. That can be the cue. Some people... Oh, an interesting one that some people have done, and they choose a different activity, one activity and a week, and each week they change what it is. So like one week, it's turning on and off light switches. Whenever you turn on and off light switches, you're going to kind of take a moment to pause and notice what's going on with you and your environment and wake up. And not just do it automatically and continue kind of an automatic pilot. And then the next week, whenever you go to the bathroom. And the next week, whenever you're on the phone. And the next week, whenever you're driving. And the next week, whenever you're washing the dishes. To bring, to kind of bring a spirit of, you can't do it, you know, if you say you want to do it continuously all day long, you're asking for failure. But if you begin exploring and getting familiar to do it in some activities, then you'll find it begins to ripple out from that. Then you have to, you do it for light switches for a week, then from then on you might kind of have this tendency to be more mindful and you turn on and off lights. And then you start doing dishes when you wash dishes. So choosing something as a cue, something to remind you, is very, very useful. The other thing that's been some people find very helpful to bring mindfulness in daily life is if your situation, if your job allows for this, is to try to do only one thing at a time. And this is certainly when you're home, you know, often that's good. If you're washing the dishes, try just washing the dishes. Be there really for the dishes. Oh, I can't use that example anymore. I was staying at someone's house. Like, I use this example pretty frequently. You wash a dish, you just stand in the sink and you just wash your dishes and it's been very valuable for me. You know, I pay attention to my feet, how I stand there. Am I really facing the dishes in the sink? Am I really present? Is mind wandering off? Or am I trying to get out of it as quickly as I can? Am I rushing through the dishes because to get to the next activity? Or am I doing dishes just to do the dishes? And I've really enjoyed myself doing dishes mindfully. But I should stop using this example because I was staying at someone's house this summer. And the first night it was time to do the dishes. And I was going to start doing the dishes. And someone pointed out, you don't do the dishes, you put everything in the dishwashing machine. And then I realized, you know, probably most of the people I speak to have dishwashing machines. It's completely irrelevant to talk about mindfulness of washing dishes. So, but to choose different activities to do kind of simply and just do this one activity. Don't talk while you do them. Don't read while you're doing it. Don't eat and just eat. Or drive and just drive. Or, you know, I feel you can fill in the blank. But it isn't that this is a moralistic thing at all. It's rather a strategy that people have found that it's extremely helpful to start waking up and being more present in your life. If you're not dividing yourself up or fragmenting yourself by doing many things at once. So you can take that as you wish, but it's offered as a support for doing this kind of practice. Another thing which some people find very helpful, both for daily meditation practice, but also for bringing it into daily life, is to sit together with other people, to meditate together with other people, to find a meditation group that you can join maybe on a weekly basis. There's a lot of support and inspiration and learning by osmosis that happens when people sit together. And you're welcome to come here on Thursday nights or Monday nights. Or there are other sitting groups around you can go to. There's a Zen center, a little lovely Zen center in Mountain View that they sit regularly there. There is a sitting group in San Jose, and there's different sitting groups around. And just finding someone to sit with is very useful. And that reminds me about what happens here on Thursdays. This is the last day of the 5-week introductory course. And next Thursday, we continue every Thursday of the year, except for when it's like Christmas or New Year's or 4th of July. Or Thanksgiving. I think, yeah, those big holidays. If they fall on Thursday, then we don't meet. But when we're not doing an introductory course, then the schedule changes. We come at 7 o'clock, and there's half an hour of meditation. And then there's 45 minutes where I give a little talk, and we have some discussion. And then we end with 15 minutes of meditation. And in the weeks after the introductory course, in my mind, I just pretend that the course is continuing. So the themes that I bring in for the first few weeks after the 5 weeks are over just tends to be things that just kind of build and continue in the basic instructions of mindfulness. So some of you might like to continue coming. So I have one more thing to say about bringing mindfulness in daily life, but I want to take a kind of a break from talking myself and give you a chance to ask questions or make comments.
I have a simple question about if you commit to a certain amount of time each day, how do you think is the best way to manage that time? Do you have a clock in front of you? Do you set a little timer?
I think it's best to have some little timer, especially people who are relatively new to meditation, to have a timer that some kind of timing device that tells you when it's over. Because if you're always looking at your clock, you know, you're constantly distracted. And it's best just to kind of close your eyes, sit there, and don't worry about the time. Or if you do worry about it, don't give in. So all kinds of things people find. I used to have an alarm clock, the old-fashioned type, wind-up kind of thing, and I would set the alarm to go off in 40 minutes, but I wouldn't turn the alarm on. I mean, I'd set the time to go, right? And so it wouldn't ring, but when it came around to that time on the clock, it would click, and then I knew it was time to get up. Some people will do, you know, other kinds of timers. And I've heard of people who tape half an hour of silence on their cassette tape. End of the half an hour, they ring a bell. Mm-hmm. And so then when they have this meditation tape, they stick in their machine when they meditate. And half an hour after sitting, ding. So, other questions or concerns? Yes.
It seems that there's a fine line between what you spoke of in terms of concentration and mindfulness. I can get a good feel for knowing where you are. They go hand in hand, but it seems like mindfulness is paramount of the two. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, there are different forms of meditation in Buddhism. And mindfulness and concentration is part of all forms of meditation. It depends on how, which is emphasized. And some forms of Buddhist meditation stress the concentration. And so that becomes the primary thing where a person is developing. But you need to have a fair amount of mindfulness to develop that concentration. What we do is we're developing mindfulness primarily. But it's very helpful to have concentration as an aid to it. But we're not letting concentration get the upper hand. The kind of concentration which we're not developing is known technically as one-pointed concentration, where the mind is fixing itself on one particular point of or object and being unwavering, not letting the mind at all be involved in anything else. So it can be the breath, it can be a mantra, it can be visualization, but the mind is unwavering on that one thing. The kind of mindfulness we're developing is a different kind of concentration. We're developing what's called momentary concentration, where you're very concentrated in the present moment for what's happening, but your awareness flows with the change of the present moment. So you're with the breath, and the breath, you're with the breath very well, and then you develop a strong itch. And rather than locking yourself in the breath at all costs, we let go of the breath and let the itch become the meditation. And you're still not getting lost in thoughts and ideas. You're very present, but you're now with the itch. And then a sound arises that's very loud. And so rather than thinking, oh, sound's bad, I'm not supposed to listen to sound, and fighting the sound, and I'm supposed to be with the itch, you know. And let go of the itch. And you know, if the sound is really what's predominant, and just very much with an easeful way, bring your meditative awareness to the sound. And so that, in that sense, the awareness is fluid in the present moment, but within the present moment, it's very concentrated in that it's in the present moment. Does that make some sense? Other concerns? Questions? Has my instructions been really clear? Yeah, really straightforward. And everybody knows what to do, and it's very nice. Yes.
In the meditation before I started there, and in that tape, he gave a lot of different methods of things that you're supposed to say, you can say,
yeah.
Rather than just focusing on the breath. And I was just wondering, I mean, he called the mindfulness meditation, I think.
Well, there's many aids to mindfulness, and he uses these what's called gathas or verses sometimes. I right now my mind's blank about some of them. Some of you know, breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I smile.
A flower or a strong mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's closely connected. It's a kind of mindfulness practice. I understand that as what he's offering is aids to developing mindfulness. They're kind of like concentration aids. They're kind of like using, like the way you have contemplative prayer in Christianity. You're using a particular word, like a mantra, that helps you, inspires you to be present. As you say, you know, breathing in, I calm body and mind. You're setting an intention and helping yourself get calm. Breathing out, I smile, creates a little bit of joy, perhaps. And Thich Nhat Hanh was very concerned, as I understand, was very concerned when he came to the West to teach, that there is a phenomenal amount of suffering in America. Many Asian teachers have come to America and said, wow, wow, what's going on here? And the amount of feeling inadequacy and insecurity and lack of self-worth and guilt and shame, and you know, it just astounds these Asian teachers sometimes. So sometimes they say, you know what we need to give these people is something kind of really simple. And be calm, be joyful, smile. You know. and I think he tuned in and offered something kind of soothing. Some people find it very, very useful to do that. I've done a little bit of his practice and I found it very nice. So you're welcome to do it. But it's not what we teach. So it's not what just, it's not simply it, you know, it's not what I teach. Eventually, I believe that even eventually, with the kind of practice that he teaches, those kinds of verses or those kinds of things have to drop away in favor of a silent awareness. And the practice that we do here, we can kind of, in a sense, kind of start with that silent awareness and find our way from the beginning to the end doing that. So, but yeah, if you find it useful, please. Yes? Start for what? Add 5 minutes a week until you get to 30 minutes. And then do that for a few weeks, and then reevaluate. And if your life is really busy and it's really a stress to do 30 minutes, then cut back and do 20. Probably shouldn't do less than 20. And if you find that half an hour works fine and your life allows you to do more, you might try 40 minutes or 45 minutes. But you know, how long you choose to do is kind of up to you and what works and what's helpful for you. I would like to be a champion for people sitting longer than half an hour, sitting for 45 minutes or an hour, maybe half an hour twice a day or something like that. But I'm reluctant to actually. I just said it. You know, so you know, people have to find what works for their life. Yeah, but it's best not to sit less than 20 minutes at a time. But it's kind of like that. Was it here last week? I told a story about the two monks who wanted to know about smoking in the monastery. So they wanted to know if they could smoke in the monastery. So the first monk went to the abbot and said, "Is it okay if we smoke while we pray?" And the abbot said, "Absolutely not. You know, who are you? You know, you're a monk and dedicated to." So the monk was kind of dejected and he left, and he saw the second monk and he said, "You know, no permission." And the second monk, "Oh, wait a minute, let me go ask." The second monk goes in and asks, "Is it okay if I pray while I smoke? Pray while I smoke?" And the abbot said, "Oh, by all means, you should pray all the time, whenever you feel like it." So I think it's best not to meditate for less than 20 minutes at a time. But if someone came to me and said, "Is it okay? Is it good to sit for 10 minutes?" You know, of course. Sit as many 10-minute sessions through the day as you can. Yes.
Are there any activities that would not be particularly compatible with the kind of mindfulness if you're able to bring it into your life?
Oh, this is an interesting question.
Emergency room personnel, bodyguard. What about, is there a way of incorporating mindfulness into these activities that do project into the future and you have to make plans?
I think so. Well, I think so. I learned a lot about mindfulness working as a fast order cook, where I couldn't do one thing at a time. I had to do 100 things at once, and it was phenomenal, you know, to be present for all those activities. So, mindfulness can be developed in many ways. I just finished writing my dissertation at Stanford, and it was a little bit hard to develop a lot of mindfulness always through the dissertation process, but it helped me a lot. One of the things that it helped me a lot with was I would notice my thoughts of that undermined my efforts. I believe it's probably fairly common for doctoral students to at least a couple of times to think, "I can't do this. This is hopeless. I'll never finish. Why did I do this? It's not for any purpose at all." So in my life before practice, I think I would have succumbed to those thoughts. I would have believed them and get lost in them. Now I saw them and just let them go right by. I just continued my work, didn't let them get in the way. So I just keep working. So mindfulness has many usefulness in many different kinds of activities. But maybe I'm a little bit reluctant to say this because I want to offer this practice without any kind of necessary ethical teaching. But my first reaction to you is yes, there are some activities that are incompatible with this practice, and they're not, and they have to do with ethical issues, not you know, busyness of the, you know, activities themselves. For example, the lawyer came and asked, can I be a student of mindfulness? In my particular office, or my particular field of law or whatever, I'm expected to lie. Can I develop my mindfulness and lie at the same time? And no, you can't. It's not possible. And there are certain activities, certain professions, which are incompatible with the kind of sensitivity that gets born with deepening mindfulness. And so some people actually will have to give up their jobs if they want to continue deepening the practice in a deep way. Or find a different office where you don't have to lie, you know, something like that. But there are activities that somehow or other bring harm to others, are incompatible with developing mindfulness. Let's end with a little sitting. It will just be pretty short. And close your eyes. And then remember that mindfulness is very simple. It's as simple as, at this very moment, what is happening for you? Experiencing what's happening for you at this moment directly, simply. Experiencing the felt sense of what's happening for you. Letting the mindfulness be like creating lots of room and space around what's happening. You don't have to do X, Y, and Z before you can be mindful. You can be mindful directly at any moment. You don't have to attain any particular state of being to wake up. So having said that, you might take a couple of deep breaths. And then inhabiting your body, settling into your body, become aware of your breathing. Letting the felt sense of breath as it is, things as they are, be there by themselves. Breathing in mindfully, breathing out mindfully. Imagine that there's a simplicity to what's happening to yourself right now. And that your job is to simply be present for what is obvious. If it's not the breath, what is it in the present moment that's most obvious that you can bring a meditative, allowing awareness to? Body sensations, sounds, feelings. Or perhaps it's just simple, the simple experience of breathing. I brought with me some more books today. You'll find out on the table there are two kinds of books. This book here, I have some copies up front too, and these are free. You're welcome to take some. They're the teachings of a Thai meditation teacher. There's a generosity is a very important part of this Buddhist tradition, and part of one form, it takes many forms, and one form is the publication of books on Buddhist practice, where people donate all the costs so the books can be distributed freely. And it isn't that the books are worthless, they're just in a tradition of a tradition where they really love, you know, generosity. So I was generously sent some 200 copies of this book. So I have to do, I'm distributing them. So you help yourself if you like. And the other book is The Voices of Spirit Rock, which is also an expression of generosity, where all the work and all the money to print it was donated so that all the proceeds from the book go towards building the meditation center at Spirit Rock, which is the big meditation center we've built in Marin County that we're connected to. And it's an anthology of 12 talks by the Spirit Rock teachers, including myself. And it's a very nice way of kind of getting a sense of all the different teachers in our tradition here in California and getting different teachings that are relevant to what you learn during the course. And that book, it's $16.25. Even though, except for tax, it all goes, it's kind of like a donation on your part. So there's that. And you'll find also out there, I don't know if there's not that many copies, but there's copies of our newsletter, and that has a schedule of different things that we do and offer as part of our meditation community. So you can welcome to take the newsletter that's there and be part of that if you'd like. And then finally, to mention one more time that there's two baskets out in the hallway. And one basket is for the rent, and if everybody put in a dollar, that would more than help pay for the rent that we use for this building. And we have other expenses also, so it's nice to collect some donations there. And the other basket is a teacher donation. If you'd like to make a donation for me, the tradition is to offer the teachings as freely as possible, just like the books. But in order for this realistically to happen, the tradition is also to put out a bowl or put out a basket so that the community then can support the continuation of this kind of teaching, to support the teachers they're doing this. And my livelihood, quite miraculously, 95 or 98% of it comes from the kind of donations I get from putting out a basket or from the kind of teaching that I do. I live in an alternative economy. It's kind of very special. So when the money I spend, all the money I have tremendous respect for, because it feels like it's been purified through this act of generosity. The kind of this system, this exchange, you know, I'm offering as freely as I can, generously I can, the teachings and the practice, and I get this wonderful donations back. And so when I spend money now, I kind of, it's like a sacred thing to me. It's really special. I wish everybody had that opportunity to experience it that way. But so there's opportunity if you want to make a donation for the class also. So I hope that this class has been useful for you, and maybe some of you will come back next week or in the future, and I look forward to seeing you. Thank you.